On ag and natural resources, and just so people know, we're going to be a little bit out of order. We have Representative Krieger here, and he has two bills that are up today, and so we're going to open both of those for hearings right off the bat, let him do his testimony, and then we'll close those hearings and go back to the regular order, just so we can let him have some time to do some other work. So I'm going to open public hearing on 3164, and I'll open a public hearing on 3165. Beth, if you want to give an explanation, and then we'll have Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3164 specifies that public lands used for wildlife management purposes must be accessible for hunting except as limited by the State Fish and Wildlife Commission for reasons of public safety or wildlife management. It requires the department, the director, to submit an annual report to the legislature that describes acres of public lands used for wildlife management that have been closed by the commission to hunting and the reasons for the closures, and also the acres opened by the commission to hunting. There is no revenue impact, minimal fiscal, and there is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Krieger.
Chair Roblin, committee members, for the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Representative from District 1. Do you care, Mr. Chair, which one I start on?
I do not, just so you
start
make sure.
3164, just briefly. It's the no net loss bill, and the no net loss of public hunting lands has become increasingly important to ensure access to current and future generations of hunters. Also referred to as the Hunting Heritage Protection Act, this bill creates a baseline number of acres of publicly owned lands open to hunting, ensuring that future generations have the same opportunity that currently exists. During December of 2006, I attended the National Association of Sportsmen's Caucus in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. One of the issue briefs discussed that we agreed to review and accept was the concept of no net loss. House Bill 3164 in Section 2 is very self-explanatory. No net loss legislation has been passed in Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Maryland, and Mississippi, and being considered in other states. With more private land being closed or tied up with hunting leases, public access for hunting is in great need. As to House Bill 3165, the mentoring bill, House Bill 3165 directs the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to establish by rule a youth hunter mentoring program. Again, this concept was one of the issue briefs discussed at the National Association of Sportsmen Caucus at Fort Lauderdale, Florida last December. At this time, children and grandchildren who have parents here in Oregon can, in fact, hunt at a lower and younger age on those lands. Except for big game. They can't get a big game tag. This bill would make it possible for more Oregon youth to experience hunting at a younger age, hopefully have an opportunity to continue enjoying taking part in hunting the rest of their lives. This idea, which is influenced by the Families of Field program, is relatively new, but it has already been enacted in several states with the assistance of the National Association of Sportsmen Caucuses. In Florida, Illinois, Louisiana, Michigan, Mississippi, Tennessee, and other states are again talking about passing this. I had an incident take place, or an opportunity, I guess you'd say, take place. My granddaughter was 10 2 years ago on our tree farm, and I was able to get her a turkey tag. And she's 10 years old, had a little 20-gauge shotgun, and within 15 minutes, she kills a turkey with an 11.5-inch beard. And I had killed a good elk, and at the time it was at the taxidermist, and she knew what the taxidermist was. Well, $500 later, I've got a mounted turkey at our home from my granddaughter. But that was a wonderful experience to have your granddaughter with you out, you know, in a place that I hope that she'll be able to take over and manage that forest land. And it's this type of thing that I think I want to work towards. And I want to say also that kids who hunt and fish usually don't use drugs. There is a correlation. You look at the kids that hunt and fish, you'll find historically that they are not the ones that you find getting themselves tied up with drugs and alcohol as often as those who don't take part in those things. House Bill 3165 is a bill that's good for kids.
So any questions from our Representative Klum?
You jealous your granddaughter's a better shot than you are?
There's a fellow by the name of Richard DeChambeau who has an outdoor show, and he had been up in Kilworth about 11-inch beard, and she called him at 6 o'clock this morning and said, Richard, I got your turkey. It's bigger than yours, and Grandpa's going to put it on the wall. He didn't even know who he was talking to, and finally he figured it out with my granddaughter. But getting kids out there and having them be with parents is very, very important.
Other questions?
Actually, I do.
Yes, Representative Mallon, a real question.
3164, is that language based on other states' language?
I think it's similar. As I recall, when I read it, it talks about the Fish and Wildlife Commission setting up a process as policies, and I believe that it's very, very similar. I don't think they're all the same from state to state.
Okay.
They would do that through administrative rule.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we're going to close our hearing on House Bill 3164, and we'll close the hearing on 3165, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2970. We'll have Beth explain it, and while we're doing that, Roy Elliker from OBFMW and Dave Clary, good to see you, Dave, from OSP will come up and talk. So.
Ron Anglin's there,
too. Oh, and Ron, you want to come up? You can as well. Anglin. Yep, there he is.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2970 clarifies the suspension and revocation of a violator's license pursuant to the Wildlife Violators Compact. There's no revenue or fiscal impact on this bill, and there are no subsequent referrals.
Mr. Chair, it's afternoon, I guess.
It is.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Chair Roblin, for the record, my name is Roy Elliker, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife for Fish and Wildlife Programs, and we are here to offer comment on House Bill 2970. What 2970 basically does, it makes some changes to a regional state compact called the Wildlife Violators Compact, and it has to do with the ability of Oregon to mirror fish and wildlife license suspensions that originate in other states. And I think what I'll do by way of background is ask Mr. Ron Anglin next to me here to walk you through Appendix 2, which is the back page of your handout, which really lays out the process and what the compact is about and why we're here and supporting the Oregon Hunter Association in these changes to the compact.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. As Roy has stated, on the back of the testimony that was submitted on page 4, we've kind of laid out a fact sheet on what the compact is all about and then how it operates here in Oregon. It is a national program first initiated in 1989. Oregon was one of the first three states to adopt specific regulations to actually start the compact. And the basic intent is to have a national effort to suspend people who have violated the laws in the member states so that they would lose their hunting or angling privileges in the other member states. And it was formed for a variety of reasons. What we were seeing was that violators were failing to comply with the terms and conditions of suspensions in some of the states. They weren't paying their fines. Then they were turning around and going and hunting someplace else. And in effect, flying in the face of what was intended to have happened. So As a member of the compact, Oregon has a process that has been identified as a problem and what we're hoping this bill would fix. And basically, the process we have to go through is identify the individuals who have been suspended in the member states, and then, by law, we have to follow a contested case hearing process in order for us to go through a suspension. And that suspension, or the contested case hearing process, can take a considerable amount of time, depending on how the violator responds to our proposed order to suspend. And we have to notify them. We give them time to respond back. If they wish to contest it, then they have to submit in writing that they wish to contest. So we go through a lengthy process before we are able to come to conclusion. And if they, in fact, do want to contest, then we have to go in front of an administrative law judge and run through the ALJ hearing process before we get a proposed order from them, and then that comes to us as an agency, and we are able to take action on that proposed order. If a violator decides they do not want to contest the action, we can complete the whole process in 4 to 6 weeks. If they decide to contest it, it can take us anywhere from 3 to 6 months before we can actually suspend them for their violation. Additionally, as noted at the bottom, you can see that in Oregon, we can suspend for a period of time based on the number of violations that they've had. And in most cases with these folks, it's a first-time violation, and we can only suspend for 24 months. However, an administrative law judge has already determined that we cannot exceed, or we have to start our suspension from the same time that they started their suspension in the originating state. So in some cases, instead of being able to suspend for a full 24 months, we can only suspend for between 15 and 18 months. And we actually had one case where it was a little bit less than that. That was the first case that we took on and ran through a very lengthy and protracted process. And that's why, if you go to page 2, it shows since we've actively been suspending people in Oregon, we've had 29 residents who have been suspended, 8 non-residents, and we have 3 currently that are pending. We also have actively, working with state police, begun to enter people into the database, and other states can take action against these people also, as according to the compact rules and regulations. So the intent of the bill is to allow the commission to suspend for a full 24 months based on the commission action versus based on when they were suspended originally, or in those rare cases where it would be appropriate to allow the commission to suspend for a longer period of time if that's what occurred in one of the other states. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Want questions now? Or let's go on and have testimony from
Chair Roblin, committee members. My name is Dave Clare. I'm with the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Section. Mr. Anglin has laid this out very well and how it's approached, so I would offer some comments about how our officers see this and how they deal with it. I personally have had experience in the past with violators in Oregon who we suspended, and 6 months later I'm investigating that person for some crime because I hear that he's got wildlife that he's not supposed to have, only to find out he went to another state. In this case, it was Idaho. So then I spend some time running it down in Idaho, getting a hold of somebody, and what turns out is Idaho ends up with a case. We don't have a case, but I've spent quite a bit of time chasing this individual around. Another situation we had was on the Columbia River, where our people worked with Washington Fish and Game. They got a violator on the Columbia River. He was suspended in Washington for some time. He just simply came across the river, started buying our non-resident licenses, and was back on the water fishing during that suspension. Washington could take no action. Our process was moving forward at a very slow rate, and I'm getting calls from my officer going, hey, we want to go get this guy. We've already spent a lot of time working him. He's a bad actor, but what can we do? This bill gives the tools to the commission to make the compact more effective for Oregon, and we see this as a very valuable tool. Our officers, almost all the time, when they're asked about a citation they're issuing to somebody, one of the first questions is, what's this going to do my license? Am I going to lose my right or my privilege to hunt and fish? It's very important. We see that as a bigger deterrent to people than actual fines. They'll pay the fine. They just don't want to lose that privilege for 2 years. In the case of out-of-state people, the answer used to be, what if I don't pay the ticket? You know, well, we'll get a warrant. If you ever come back to Oregon, maybe we'll arrest you. But other than that, we couldn't do anything. Now we say, you don't take care of business in Oregon, we're going to notify your state. You'll be suspended in your state until you come back and take care of what's going on in Oregon. So there's some good things in here. There's safeguards that if some state has a unique law that Oregon doesn't, if it doesn't qualify in Oregon as a suspendable offense, he won't be suspended in Oregon. So our residents are protected. But if they go poach a big game animal in Idaho, they should be suspended in Oregon. And with the mobile society we have, you know, we have people crossing these lines. We're working these cases with other states now. Our officers are talking back and forth. They hear rumors, hey, this guy's going to go to Idaho because he's suspended in Oregon. You know, we're finding somebody saying, here's where he's coming, here's what he looks like. You might see these vehicles. It's been a good tool for us, and I think it's going to be better.
So any questions? Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have four questions, and I don't necessarily need an answer. I didn't bring them, but I'd like to get the answers, and I don't need the answers before I vote yes either. But actually, my four questions are actually rather simple. I'm interested in the total number of hunting licenses issued, and pick a year, last year, year before, whatever you have total data. Total number of hunting license issues, total number of angling license issued, then the total number of violators, and of the total number of violators, how many resulted in suspensions. So I'm trying to look to see how, for the good lieutenant there, how many bad apples we have.
Chair Roblin, Representative Boquist, we can get that information back to you pretty quickly here, probably in the next couple of days.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions of this group? Well, I want to thank all of you for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We also have Dave Clary, I'm sorry about that, Al Elkins of Oregon Hunters Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. First of all, Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank the committee for introducing this bill for us. This is a bill at the request of the Oregon Hunters Association, and we greatly appreciate the committee sponsoring the bill for us. So thank you for doing that. I can't add any more than Mr. Anglin did in his overview of what the system is and what it does. During the interim, the department talked to the Oregon Hunters Board of Directors and said that they had this little gray area in this law that they needed some work with and would need a bill to resolve that. The Oregon Hunters Board has been very, very supportive of this and actually was instrumental in getting the department to implement this system. It kind of spread like wildfire. If you saw the map, it just kind of went across the United States, and we were very excited about Oregon becoming a member of that system. I don't want us to lose sight of the fact that it's a very complicated system, but in the middle of my testimony, what we're addressing in the bill is answering the question, when does the suspension clock begin ticking? And on page 2, section 4A, that answers that question and allows the department to hang their hat on that language that they needed to have put into statute. So that's what this bill does, in essence. Again, thank you for sponsoring the bill. We greatly appreciate it. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here who would like to speak to House Bill 2970? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on 2970 and we'll open a work session on 2970.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2970 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boquist has moved House Bill 2970 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Okay. Then we'll take a roll call vote on House Bill 2970. Those in agreement will say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Dinkfelder.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Excused.
Representative Boquist.
Aye.
Representative Flynn.
Aye.
Chair Roper.
Ooh. Aye, and we have... We'll give it. Do we have to do anything different?
Do
you have an opportunity to vote? We're still voting, so you want to vote on the violators count?
Yeah, it's a good bill. I would vote aye. Thank you.
Great timing. The bill is passed.
Did I pass
it? Yes, it is.
It's unanimous, and there's no opposition. I would say recommend we move it to consent calendar. Mm-hmm.
Is there any disagreement with moving it to...
So move, Mr. Chair.
Okay. It was moved. Do we need to take a vote?
Okay,
unanimous is okay without objection. We will put that on the consent agenda. Thank you very much.
It's
my turn to carry. I know
that. No, that's good.
I asked those questions in case I got
asked. Oh, okay, that's good.
Yeah, that's good.
We will now open a public hearing on 3164. And we're going to invite Representative Quinn. You want to go down? Yeah. The easiest way.
Yeah.
What would it be like if we, when we sponsored something, we had to abstain or something?
Yeah.
Declare conflict of interest.
Exempted,
this was
yeah.
our bill.
But he's co-sponsored this one. This is not just a regular
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Brian Clem, State Representative for Central and East Salem. And I obviously support the bill. I'm one of the chief co-sponsors of the bill. And what Representative Krieger talked about, I just want to sort of add to that a little bit. And I know some of you have seen that this is not quite as uncontroversial, because you probably have a letter in your bill file like I got as the last bill. So I want to be able to answer questions that people have as well about it. After we get through the public testimony, I can do that from the dais. The bill essentially specifies that public lands that are used for wildlife management purposes, anyway, not all public lands, but the ones used for wildlife management purposes, must be accessible for hunting, with some exceptions. It requires the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to avoid making management determinations that result in net loss of access to hunting on public lands. And so if there's an area that would need to be in the Fish and Game Department's, we don't call it that anymore, do we? Fish and Wildlife Department's estimation needs to be off limits for a reason, that then we would make efforts to make sure that something else is brought in so there's no net loss. The Fish and Wildlife Director also would be asked to make a report each legislative assembly on the number of acres that were gained during that period that are accessible for hunters and the number of acres lost, so we would be able to keep track on an ongoing basis. And that's essentially the bill. And the reason for the bill, and I think many of you know I've talked about it. I hunt every year, several different things. I love it. It's one of the great joys of my life. I do it with my dad generally every year and my friends and brothers. But it is becoming more difficult to find places to hunt. When I was in Corvallis, there was this one hill outside of Philomas. It seemed like everybody and their mother was out there on opening morning because it was the one easily accessible public piece of property that we could find. And it's a real issue. I've seen testimony and in the letter that there is no evidence of any problems with lands being unavailable for hunting purposes. I got a letter that told me that, and I'm just wondering if these people could maybe take me to where they know about it, because I go all over the place, and it is difficult and becoming more difficult. And public lands are public lands for a reason, and these particular public lands are for wildlife management purposes. And what sometimes I think people fail to understand is that hunters play the role of wildlife managers. That's why we have controlled hunts and a tag system. So instead of people seeing starving deer because we know there's going to be overpopulation, we allow a certain number of tags to be issued, and the hunters do it not just for free, they actually pay to do it, which some might find us, why would we do that when someone could pay us? But we love it, and we want to do it, and that's why we do it. And this bill just says that the public lands for this purpose, we're taxpayers too, and we should be able to keep at least what we've got in Oregon. Oregon was clearly built on a theory of the pioneer spirit, and this is how people ate, and some folks still like to go out and enjoy themselves and get food at the same time, and I don't want to see our state go further down the road of losing public lands for hunting purposes. That's all I've got. I'd be happy to take questions or return back to my little seat and participate after others are done.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes, Representative Dingfelder.
For Representative Plum, my staff is here, so maybe she'll hang out while I ask my question. Sorry about that. I hope you're going to declare a conflict of interest when you vote for this bill.
Yeah. I'm part of a big class, but yeah.
Do you, and maybe I'm assuming the department will come up to address this as well,
yep.
But do you have information about how many, because in your opening comments you talked about the loss of hunting lands, do you have information about the number of acres that, I mean, I'm assuming then there has to be some loss over time.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, so what I would need to see is information about if this is actually a trend that's occurring,
sure.
Because of Endangered Species Act or what, and when the department comes up, I'm sure they can probably address this. But and the other question I have is so I'm assuming that you think that the commission isn't adequately balancing. I mean, it's the same type of discussion we've had with the Department of Forestry and the Forest Commission. I mean, we have a commission, and they're supposed to be balancing these different interests and needs. So I guess if you want to comment on either of those, it'd be helpful.
Yeah, and maybe they can get to the, mine is more anecdotal from my own experience, except that we already passed a bill to allow in the Habitat Conservation Program, we wanted to make sure that people who participated in habitat conservation didn't take their lands out of permission to hunt because they were worried about liability. And you recall we all passed a bill through the House that said that we were going to not have liability for people just for participating in habitat conservation. Well, those folks had taken their acreage out of hunting accessibility because they were afraid of being sued just for participating and trying to restore habitat. So that was, I think, 6,600 acres just in that particular category.
Represent that's, Mr. Chair, private land.
No, I know.
So we're
I'm just talking about overall, and I'll let the department speak to pure public land, but overall there's certainly a loss of lands, and this legislature has already been taking steps to try and restore that in categories that we can. This would be an additional step. The second question was...
It was about the commission. Part of their job role is to balance this competing demands, so to speak, and that's, part of the role that they play as serving as commissioners.
On lands that they own... I feel like they have, or manage, they do have a role in understanding the various, the schemes that we have to judge how much fish and wildlife are out there and then how we deal with that is under their terrain. I don't think they're really empowered nor entitled yet without legislative direction to look at the issue of loss of hunting access. They have, and you could ask the department maybe for what they consider their role to be, but I consider their role to be more about managing the game and not necessarily the accessibility to it. So they might issue tags that say we have 500 we have enough room for 500 of a certain species to be harvested. That doesn't mean that there's going to be accessibility onto public lands for the hunters to go do it. It just means there's 500 that would be allowed, but that doesn't mean you can get in the road. That doesn't mean the gate's locked. I mean, there are a lot of things that when you actually go out to try and hunt, you find that it's not accessibility, even though you've got a tag that you drew that says, yeah, we do need to harvest this animal for our calculations of what's the right ecosystem balance, but you can't get there. And that's really the issue. And I don't know that the commission has enough direction that we want to deal with not only harvest levels, but accessibility to harvest.
Thank you. one final question?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank
President
you. Well, you know, he's a freshman, so we have to make sure he gets indoctrinated. Since my understanding is that the fastest growing recreational element for the department and, you know, for usage in the state, and Roy can nod yes or no on this, is passive wildlife viewing. As far as actually, that's sort of the fastest growing part or the largest, you know, increase in the what the department's seeing. And so I guess I'm curious if you think that it should be based on, you know, the usage. So we set aside a certain percentage for passive wildlife viewing versus hunting. I mean, that part of the mm-hmm. dilemma for me is we've got to balance all the different users.
Sure.
And, you know, so how does the department do that? Do they do it based on a formula? Is it based on, I mean, right now my understanding is it's based on wildlife management and what's the area needed, you know, to sure. manage for wildlife habitat and populations.
Yeah, I think that the uses aren't mutually exclusive, so two things can occur simultaneously. I mean, there's many times where, because I'm not that good of a shot, I've viewed the wildlife as it ran away from me. I just missed it.
Now, he hasn't visited me, obviously.
Yeah.
You need to spend some time with Representative Oquist. He might be able to help
the
you.
The B-squared will kind of worry about
it. Yeah, all right.
Anyway.
The other piece of it is our calendar sort of dictates. You know, hunting season isn't all year long. There's a prescribed time, and so, you know, 50 weeks out of the year, that's when you view it. Then there's 2 weeks where you finally, you know, if you're me, you get a shot at it. And so the other 50 weeks, people who enjoy just viewing wildlife, I have no problem that they want to be there and they have 50 weeks locked up. I just want a shot at my two, and that's what the hunters of Oregon want.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will make sure and stay out of the woods those 2 weeks that Representative Clem is hunting, because I'm a little concerned.
Representative Oakland.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have two quick questions. As a chief co-sponsor, I know legislative revenue says there's no revenue impact, and legislative fiscal says there's minimal expenditure impact. And as a co-chief sponsor, do you concur with those?
As long as we don't take more lands off the table, then we'll be fine on the revenue side.
We have a letter in. We're waiting.
Thank you.
I have a serious question on that one.
Alex,
The other thing, I just didn't comment on the other bill while we were voting on it, but I'm really proud of Hunter for stepping up and policing themselves, because that's one of the deals. A lot of times people's experiences with hunters are with people who are doing things that are unlawful. And, you know, there's in the hunting community, there's sometimes more than words change hands when you witness something like that yourself, of someone that you're out there and you see something doing something you shouldn't do. And I'm glad they'll lose their license, because, you know, it makes everybody look bad who's just trying to enjoy an activity that's been passed down through the generation. So just chiming in after the fact on that one, Ron, down here. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have... Well, we might as well go with Roy Elliker and Al Elkin. And we can prep, yeah.
Ron's here, too.
And Rod Harder, all three come on up.
And
Ron Englund is here. We'll wait and get you guys right afterwards, however you want to do it. No, go on, come on.
Yeah, that would be only if they take more time.
We'll let this back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder, the representative for the National Rifle Association in Oregon. After listening to Representative Clem, I was very inclined to come up here and say, me too. thank you very much, sir. You very well articulated our position on the bill. A couple of things about the bill that need a little bit of discussion. One is, and you'll hear in the testimony on the next bill, one of the biggest challenges facing fish and wildlife is the retention of hunters. Every year we seem to lose more and more hunters. And one of the reasons is lack of opportunity, and much of that lack of opportunity is caused by lack of access to land. This bill really is, to answer Representative Maurer's question previously, this is modeled after the Florida bill, which was the first one in the nation and is the one that NRA usually uses for a model. But this is considerably less involved than the bill in Florida. And we went through this last session, and actually the bill passed and then was never heard in the Senate. This only addresses public lands that are managed by Fish and Wildlife, because that simplifies the procedure. One of the questions Representative Dingfelder asked was included in the previous version last session, and that was an inventory. But Fish and Wildlife felt that that would be too complicated to inventory all of the land, so we removed that portion. And we ended up basically with what we have now. Private lands are not addressed in this bill, although in the future perhaps we could look at it again after it's in place for a couple of years and see if the access and habitat program could not be used as a mitigating factor for some loss of land somewhere else. We have a very, the access and habitat program has finally started to function extremely well, and we're adding more lands as we go along. We have discussed, and Representative Boakley brought up the referral to Ways and Means, and I would assume that the chair will handle that because I'm certainly incapable of doing it. This trend is occurring nationally. We have a number of states that have already put it in place. It's working well, and hunters like it. It's doing a good job for them in other states, and we would encourage you to help us do that here. And I'd be happy if I could answer any questions.
Any questions? Seeing none, we'll move on to Al.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. I really can't add any more than to what Representative Clem said and Mr. Harder, other than the two issues that are confronting us every day that we're here are land access to land and youth. So you're hearing both of those today and solutions to them. We're very supportive of the wording in this, and I'd like to see these types of discussions at the commission level, and I think that's what the bill does, is it provides a vehicle for them to have these discussions by setting it in policy. So we're very supportive of this bill.
Any questions? Yes.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm actually looking at the wildlife policy that's referenced in 496.012, and Representative Dinkfelder brought up a point that the commission may not, or we may be getting into their weed patch, so to speak. And in reading the seven different goals of wildlife management, of which the ORS says that each of the goals are co-equal, it doesn't address anything about acreage or avoidance or loss avoidance. And so it addresses a bunch of other issues, but it doesn't address this at all. And so do you feel that this language is going to clear up that discussion in the commission level?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I'm not familiar with the section. I have not read that, so I can't answer that question. I don't know, Ron.
Representative Maurer, Chair Roldman, Representative Maurer, those seven co-equal positions in the wildlife code were put into effect, I think, about 10 years ago, and we went through the entire agency function and massaged the whole thing. This was when the landowner preference business took place, and you're right, it's not addressed in there, but I do think this bill, in fact, does address the acreage question.
Thank you. Thank you both. So Ron, want to come on up?
I like all this testimony. Cut more trees down, make more paper. Increase more jobs in my district.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. We have another bill being heard on the Senate side on sturgeon, so Roy had to run over there for that. And
good bill.
I fished all day Saturday and caught nothing.
It's one of my bills. That's
we learned to expect it.
Yeah.
Smoked a barbecue sturgeon.
Chair Roblin, the department in reviewing the bill sees that it has no fiscal impact on us. We have had discussions with the sponsors of the bill, and it appears that their intent is aimed at lands that the department controls and operates. I will tell you that we are in the middle of our wildlife area management review process right now, and we have 12 or 13 of those that we're preparing plans on. And we frequently are receiving testimony that these lands should, in fact, be closed to hunting and only be used for viewing, biking, hiking purposes only. Obviously, we need to take those comments under consideration, but it does conflict with what some of the primary uses of those lands are and the purposes they were acquired for and the funding that was used to purchase those lands. So we are seeing increasing pressure from the public to close down our lands to hunting opportunities because it conflicts with things that they would like to do. And frequently, our lands are only open for a short period of time during specific hunting seasons, and the rest of the year, unless it's sensitive wildlife habitat for certain times, the rest of the year it is open for public viewing and access and recreational purposes. With that, Chair, I really have nothing else to testify on. Be willing to answer any questions. Okay.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, okay. So I'm going to, I won't ask you exactly the same question, but these co-equal goals, number one, it says to maintain all species of wildlife at optimum levels. If you did not have hunters, how would you suggest we maintain at optimum levels? I mean, I suppose we could set snares. I know that works well with cougars because we have that testified.
Okay. Advisor, you better calm him down before I go over the details.
Chair Roblin, Representative Maurer, what you're referring to is the wildlife policy in 496.012, and there are the seven co-equal goals. And you have to recognize that to implement those seven goals, we depend primarily on revenues that are derived from the sale of hunting licenses and tags, and then also revenues that we acquire from the federal government that are based on a formula on the number of licenses and tags that we sell. So it would be difficult for us as an agency to fulfill some of the goals as outlined within the wildlife policy without that revenue stream. Loss of hunting opportunity on our lands can lead to loss of our ability to manage those lands without another source of revenue. Now, we do manage our lands in a broad term and in a broad landscape type of manner and do try to address recreational opportunities outside of hunting. But we rely on hunter dollars to manage that and with no contribution at all from the non-hunting public at this point in time.
Representative?
Follow-up question to Representative Maurer's question, more pointed. I think, and I'm looking for a yes or no answer. You need hunters in order to manage the overpopulation of some game species.
Chair Roblin, Representative Boquist, I hate yes or no answers.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's happening to the total number of hunting tags that's being issued in the state? Is there a trend line? Is it increasing? Is it decreasing? What's happening in that area?
Chair Roblin, Representative McPherson, some of what you've asked we were planning on touching on in the testimony on the next bill, the Minard Youth Hunting Bill. But we have seen a general decline in hunting opportunity as far as tags that we issue, primarily in eastern Oregon, as a result of some of those deer and elk populations declining. Some of that has been due to our actions in that we have brought herds down to management objective levels, but we have seen a decline in hunting and we have seen a decline in license sales over the course of the last 20 years.
Oh, if I could. Quite aside from whether the areas of access and the number of animals that you've determined it's appropriate to cull. Quite aside from that, what's the public interest level? That is it kind of a steady number of people who are interested in getting a hunting tag? Is it declining? Is it increasing? What's happening to sort of the public's interest in participating?
Chair Roblin, Representative McPherson, we have seen a decline in sales, but I don't think you can equate that to a decline in interest. And part of that is due to the fact that we have seen a decline in resident license buyers, but an increase in non-resident license buyers. And we currently cannot meet all the demand for hunting opportunity in eastern Oregon in particular, where we are everything is by controlled hunt during the rifle season. So we frequently will see people that they can't hunt here, so they go to another state.
Okay.
I'm going to ask a question to kind of clarify a little bit too there, I hope. And we control the number of tags that get bought because of the need we need to take animals. And so it can go up and down depending on what our expectation is. And we don't let just people buy hunting licenses if there isn't anything they can hunt. Is that true?
Chair Roblin, that's correct. We manage populations based on their biological surplus and offer hunting opportunity based on that.
And so the number of tags sold is really dependent on the wildlife available rather than on the need.
It's two seasons.
Yeah. Is that true?
That's correct, Chair Roblin.
Yes,
Chair, I guess I disagree, or maybe we're not talking about the same instances, because in the elk season, you can only draw a tag, but in the second season, anybody can buy a hunting license tag.
It's because it's so hard to get one during that
time.
Well,
I know.
Yeah,
right.
Chair Roblin, Representative Smith, there are multiple elk seasons that are controlled hunts during both seasons. We do have some that are general season opportunities. What we have done, though, is we have had some of those seasons where we have cut back on opportunity, primarily by reducing the number of days available to hunt, because we have seen decreases in bull escapement levels, or we have seen decreases in buck escapement levels. So we have reduced opportunity based on the biological potential, short of going to a full controlled hunt.
Follow up. I guess I just want clarification then on the, say, the second season of elk season. Cannot anybody buy a hunting license and tag to go out?
Chair Roblin, Representative Smith, it depends on the unit that you're looking at.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And
it's been a while.
My last question.
Wow.
Has the access to parts of our state lands decreased over the years, increased, or stayed about the same? I mean, have we seen, you know, what this bill addresses is trying to keep it where it's at right now. Have we seen adjustments in that over the last few years?
Chair Roblin, I'm not aware of any state lands that we have direct control over that have been lost to hunting opportunity in recent years. I'm not aware of any.
I guess, it's... The lands that we control, have all of them always been state lands, or are some of those lands that have been purchased, say, from other organizations and given to the state to manage?
Chair Roblin, it's a combination. Some are lands that we have purchased directly. Some are lands that have been granted to us. Some are lands that we have acquired from the federal government, military bases, things like that. So it's a combination of all of those. Now, there are some state lands that may not be open, like South Slough down in your country, Representative. So it depends on the circumstances and where it's located, but at least the lands that we manage at this point in time, they're all open to hunting.
Okay. Representative Bota.
Mr. Just like the clarification that came from Representative Smith, and that there are certain areas where you can't have open hunting on the western side and you can't. Likewise, open access is not a well-defined issue, because if you have a road closure and now you have to walk 25 miles, there are some of us that are old enough that it's not open access.
So. It's called a camping experience.
Yeah. Well, hiking
experience.
Yes. Thank you. Well, I don't have any other questions.
I have a question, Chair, if there's no other testimony. Right
there's
here.
One more person. Laurel Hines.
What am I doing? From the long distance. Well, excuse me, my name is Laurel Hines, and I really hate to be opposed to anything Representative Clem has proposed.
I'm
in
support of your election, so I feel terrible about this.
I know. Well, normally we're lockstep, but I am all right.
Well, I'm opposed to this bill, and this is the first hunting-related thing I've ever come about. But I have several concerns, and one is that I'm an avid hiker, and I have tried to hike in hunting areas in hunting season, because fall is a good time to hike. And I've been afraid of being shot at, and I've been in some areas where there have been hunters nearby, probably where they shouldn't have been. But anyway, I don't like being shot at. And I have to wear orange in order to protect myself.
Don't shoot your constituents.
And my volunteers.
So anyway, I think my belief is that the other gentleman mentioned that there's been a decline in hunting, and I think, you know, I question whether there's a decline because of lack of opportunity or a change in interest. I think more and more people are beginning to like hunting or hiking, and like was mentioned, photography and other forms of passive wildlife viewing, and fewer people are interested in hunting. I think more people are getting growing in their consciousness about animal suffering and about the balance of nature and even the value of predators. I think that's why the voters twice voted down cougar hunting in their initiatives, and yet people are trying to overcome that also. I think as the population grows, at some point, we're going to get so many people, and if hunting grows in popularity, there will be an impact on wildlife, and in order to have conservation, I think they're going to have to withdraw areas from hunting. I also think that the hunters are not the foremost supporters of scientifically sound wildlife management. Hunters tend to like to take out the predator animals so that there's more prey for the hunters instead of letting the balance of nature take place. And I think in the normal balance of nature, the predators like the cougars or wolves, whatever, tend to take out the more sickly animals, allowing the healthier animals to reproduce, which creates, at least scientifically from what I've read, a healthier population for the future. And I think we shouldn't interfere with what scientists and U.S. Fish and Wildlife believes is the best way to manage wildlife, even if that means taking some areas out of hunting and actually diminishing the total acreage for hunting for periods of time if that's necessary. I don't believe recreational hunting is an essential component of wildlife management. I think it's one of them. And I think at some point in the future, they may have to use hiking fees, of which, by the way, I pay some kind of fee when I get my tags to go hiking on public lands. And I don't know where that money goes. I thought it was for wildlife management.
Black hole of the federal government.
Well, wherever it goes. But I pay that fee not every here. Year.
Northwest Forest Pass, probably.
The other thing is that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, I just read that there has been severe declines in their funding, and maybe the other gentleman can speak to this. But I just read last week that a bunch of, sorry to speak so informally, but many refuges, I don't think very many right in this locale, but a number of U.S. Fish and Wildlife managed refuges have been suffering decline because of budget cuts. And it seems to me that this proposal is going to create a lot of paperwork and reports for them to fill out when they already have a decline in budgets. I would rather see them maintaining the wildlife refuges. And I live close to the Ankeny Refuge, and if anybody has hiked into the interior of the Ankeny Refuge, they will see severe overgrowth of ivy and invasive species taking over the refuge that nobody goes out to manage. So I would like to see most of our funding go into helping the wildlife refuges instead of harming them. And by the way, I have a fairly good friend of our family that hunts frequently, and somehow he finds places to go after work on weekdays to hunt during deer and elk season. I don't know where he goes, but he never seems to have a problem finding a place. So I believe that hunters possibly wouldn't need to manage the overcrowded population of prey if the predators were not killed off by humans. So that's my main testimony. Thank you very much for the opportunity. And sorry I'm looking a little grubby. I came right from a volunteer job at the Humane Society.
No problem. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So is there any... yes, please come forward. And be sure and state your name. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Larry Harvey. I apologize for arriving late for the committee hearing and wasn't able to sign up to testify, but I am here today on behalf of Safari Club International. You've heard all the expert testimony already, and so I can tell you right now, I have no new information other than to tell you that the Safari Club does support all three of the bills that you've actually been talking about today, that they're very interested in seeing these move forward, so they have no objections. Anecdotally, I can also share with you that it just so happens that the American Wildlife Conservation Partnership is conducting a convention in Portland at this very moment as we are speaking and meeting on this. I had the privilege of attending a meeting last night. It was a very interesting gathering of a lot of folks from all over the United States. The scope of the presentation, though, however, was very intriguing in that it pertains specifically to the partnerships being developed in the state of Wyoming through the federal government to provide more accessibility to public lands. Obviously, part of that activity would be for hunting. The vast majority of that activity was more specific to both grazing and managing wildlife and providing them with specific habitat. So this is not unique to Oregon. In fact, is a concern that runs completely across the United States, and so maybe perhaps some of the money that goes into the black hole the federal government is getting into the Wyoming habitat. I'm not quite sure, but the government is promoting something, and in fact, they were calling upon the attendees at the convention last night to help develop public-private partnerships to support that. So thank you again very much.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Anyone else who would like to say, well, any questions? And I see no one else. I will close our public hearing on 3164. Did you have a comment you wanted to make?
I just have an observation or a question of the chair.
Okay.
Observation is, I mean, we officially don't have wolves yet, even though they're out there. And I would say that the Fish and Wildlife Commission has already stated and put into place a cougar management plan simply because of the fact that the cougars are overpopulating, and I'm not advocating one way or the other here, overpopulating, and so we don't have a lack of predators at this particular point. I would share the lady's concern about the federal government closing things down, but I'm not sure we can address that. And the bill pretty much asked for a balance. And finally, my question to the chair is, it does seem rather unusual that my sheet here says this as a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means when there is not a impact.
We have sent a letter requesting that it be removed. And before we take action, I expect that will be done.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
So, Mr. Chair, I might also say I do not hunt any predators. I know people do. I don't. I do occasionally go to Outback Steakhouse because that's a little less sporting than my hunting because I'm not that good of a hunter. But that there might be something there that's a predator. That's about all I got.
I would just say it is important if you're not going to hit the animal that you not go after the predator.
just deer and grouse.
So we will open a public hearing on 3165. And we already had a short explanation. So, Roy's here, so we can have Roy and Ron come on up, and we'll start with them.
They're already doing like 7 simultaneous reports, and they collect the data.
Excuse me, no problem. While we're going out, actually, while we get beginning of this, I did want to make a little statement to the hunters and others, and I think that right now, the reason that we have some of the wildlife we have in this state is largely dependent on the fact that hunters have spent a lot of their money making sure there is habitat and other stuff available for our bird population in particular, but for other populations as well. And, you know, I get frustrated sometimes when people put a lot of time, effort, and money in, and I agree that I look at some of these places that I hike and I watch it getting overgrown with things like invasive species, and few people that go out and hike and take care of that go out and take care of those things. The converse has been true with the hunting associations and others who have, in fact, when they saw a problem, gone out, put their money and efforts into making those things work. And I we need to continue to get all of our communities working together to solve some of these problems. And I appreciate the comments on the on seeing those invasive species out there and not anybody doing anything about it. So communities have to take care of those things. But yes, now you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, once again, my name is Roy Alliker, Deputy Director for Fish and Wildlife Programs. And on my left, Mr. Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator, again, for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Regarding House Bill 3165, I know each of you as members of this committee and as concerned people in Oregon who like to do things in the outdoors and who also a number of you like to hunt and fish are aware that hunting participation has declined in a lot of areas in the country, if not most states. And in Oregon, it's been declining for about 2% a year for about the last 10 years. So, especially as a function of as new people move to the state, less and less of those people are getting involved in hunting and other outdoor pursuits, at least generally. So a couple of years ago, actually a year and a half ago, we brought together a group of outdoors folks, particularly hunters, to talk about ways that we can bring our participation level, if not back to where it was, at least get more people interested. Because, again, when we talk about hunting, in a lot of ways we talk about outdoor recreation in general, hunting being one form of that. Anyway, we brought a bunch of folks together, both professionals who deal with youth programs like this and others, and one of their ideas, which we put into a form of a bill, and is in front of you today, is the Youth Mentor Program. A number of other states have done something like this. Oregon has when you get right to it, in Oregon, you're not allowed to hunt for big game, actually deer and elk and some other animals, till age 12. And when you look around the states, particularly to the east, that's actually a pretty high age. In a lot of other states, it's probably 10 or there's no minimum age. Hunter education is always usually a prerequisite, of course. But when we talk to some of the experts around the country about things that are going on in trends of participation, one of the ideas was this mentoring program where youth, particularly less than 12, would go out with an adult and actively hunt. The adult would not carry a weapon. The adult is there to help coach the child who's out hunting and really make it a real bonding experience and also get the person, you know, out there in the outdoors and doing some hunting before age 12. And studies have shown pretty statistically sound studies have shown that really by the time a youngster gets to age 12, some of that may be too old for them to get interested in outdoor pursuits like hunting. Frankly, it's when they're a little younger, 7, 8, 9, 10. And frankly, if you think back, and a lot of the other hunters I talked to think back, I was that age when I started getting interested in hunting and those kinds of things. So this bill, all the bill really does is to allow the department to allow the commission to adopt by rule put together a youth hunter mentoring program that allows young people 9 years or older to hunt in the presence of a supervisory hunter who's 21 years or older and holds appropriate license tags and otherwise. And so you're going to have some other good testimony here from other wildlife groups really supporting this legislation. But that's essentially what the bill does. There is an amendment that the department asked, which changed the upper age, or put a limit on the upper age of 14. We're asking for that amendment because after the age of 14, young folks can actually go out and hunt by themselves without any adult supervision when they turn 14. And so we wanted to be sure that somehow we didn't inadvertently create a system that allowed a young person to go through their younger years and not take hunter education at some point, because we do have very strong hunter education in the state. It's been well proven that it does a good job of educating young hunters, particularly about safety and other outdoor issues before they go out. So we didn't want to inadvertently create a way for some young people to somehow never get to take hunter education before they start hunting. So we would ask that amendment also be adopted by the committee. And with that, that's really all my prepared statements, but answer any questions here today.
Any questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alliker, are we having a problem in terms of doing the wildlife management we need to do? And I recognize that hunters play an important role in managing certain of our species population control. Are we at a point where we don't have enough interest to manage those populations effectively? or would you anticipate we would get to that point?
Chair Roblin, Representative McPherson, it's a question that many states are wrestling with that very question, and it's not, most states are not at some critical stage today, but as you look into the future, and when frankly that's where you get into a discussion of what is referred to in my business as the North American Fish and Wildlife Model, which is the most successful probably in the world, where at the turn of the 20th century, Teddy Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot, all those folks, and all these hunter organizations came forward to push for conservation, and that they would be willing to pay. General public wouldn't pay. The hunters and fishermen would be willing to pay. Mm-hmm. So now, for the last 100 years or so, the whole, in every state, almost every state, there's a couple exceptions at this point, maybe 3 or 4, almost every state, a major piece of the wildlife management money comes from what we in Oregon refer to as other funds, essentially hunting and fishing license fees. As time goes on into the future and folks see declining participation rates in those two areas, that is an area of concern financially for state fish and wildlife management agencies. And so you're essentially correct. We don't have a problem today, but in 20 years, perhaps.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Rod Harder.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder, Oregon consultant for the National Rifle Association. The piece that you'll be receiving, I'm reading from a fourth piece of the same thing in deference to my eyesight. I'm here to give you a brief outline of what the bill does and to review the reasons I asked Representative Krieger to sponsor it for us. There are more individuals here today that can give you background on some of the other states where this has been put into effect. As we've heard, one of the biggest challenges that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife faces is addressing the decline in hunting license sales. And this is an ongoing issue. It's been going on and declining for the last 10 years or so. Contributing to this problem are large numbers of adult hunters dropping out for a number of reasons, and a very significant lack of young people who are coming into the program. With the event of computer games and what have you, we're finding a lack of interest by youth in coming into hunting. The Youth Hunting Report, a national study of hunting replacement ratios for ages 6 through 16, conducted by several professional organizations, Oregon was ranked as number 48 out of 50 states in terms of recruiting young people into hunting. The Oregon ratio was 0.35 when the mean of 1.0 was necessary to remember those numbers established in the year 2000. Oregon is also one of the states with the most restrictive minimum age limits and stringent hunter education requirements that must be met before most types of hunting by youth hunters are permitted. And I guess I'll have to take partial blame for that, because we always thought that a really good hunter education course was productive, and it is. However, it serves as a detriment for those people who have gotten to age 12 and have some other outside interests. There's a direct negative correlation between restrictive youth regulations and the recruitment of young people into hunting. Obviously, if we're going to reverse this, you have to take an immediate action, and this bill should do that, or at least take a step towards doing that. It's fairly simple in concept. Directs the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission to establish by rule a program that allows the youth between the ages of 9 and 14 to hunt for big game when in the presence of a mentor. The mentor must be a licensed hunter, 21 years of age or older. There will only be one firearm allowed, and the licensed hunter's tag may be used by the youth if he or she successfully takes an animal. The youth will be able to participate in this program until they reach age 14. That level is established in the -1 amendments that have been handed out. At that time, they'll be required to successfully complete a hunter education program before they can continue to hunt. Currently, 12 states that have a program in effect. A report at the North American Wildlife and Natural Resources Conference in Portland last week stated that half the states that have the program have reported a significant climb in new hunters. Data from Florida, Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota, Mississippi, and Ohio reveals that the apprentice hunting license programs collectively brought over 34,000 new hunters to the field, and this is very important, without a single hunting-related accident. Hunting-related shooting accident. There was one kid that fell down and broke a leg, but that was not involved with the firearm. We have not discussed any license requirement or cost to the youth, and we would hope that there would be very minimal. The mentor will be purchasing the tags and the hunting license, an appropriate tag. Should the commission decide that some kind of registration scheme is necessary, the cost should be minimal, and we would view that as being an investment in future income. Finally, the Dash 1 amendment adds an emergency clause to the bill. Discussions with Fish and Wildlife Agency indicated they'd like to have this program up and running by in time for the 2007 season. You'll hear a wide-ranging support on the legislation. We believe it's a great bill, and we certainly would urge your support. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions?
I had one.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Harder. You said data from Florida, Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota, Mississippi, and Ohio reveal that 34,000 new hunters. Were those all youth hunters?
Chair Roblin, Representative Smith, that collectively in those states, 34,000.
Of the youth hunters?
Were youth hunters. There are a couple of states, and I don't have numbers, that have what they call an apprentice program where people can hunt like this with a licensed hunter who are over the age of 14. But those figures were not stated separately.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that last one sounded like a way, if there's no age limit, for me to get my dad to buy my tags. Cause if
there you go.
Yeah.
Oh. John Thebes.
That's right. Name ammunition company. Happily sell you ammo.
I claim I'm an apprentice still.
Committee Chair, Representative Roblin, committee members. For the record, my name is John Thebes, 1084 Castlewood Drive, Medford, Oregon. My background is in a former career. I have been a hunter education instructor and formerly employed by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife as the state's hunter education coordinator. And currently I am a wildlife biologist with the National Wild Turkey Federation. You'll have to excuse me from squirming a little bit. I've been working with private landowners just west of here, and I've acquired a little bit of poison oak while working on some oak woodlands and some endangered species habitat. So, the National Wild Turkey Federation is very active in the Families Afield Initiative, which some of your people today have mentioned. And I could go into the statistics that speak that states that have no minimum age have higher hunter recruitment within their states and have a better hunting safety record than states having age limitations. But beyond those statistics, I'd like to talk from a father of four kids and how and active kids that are both active in school and extracurricular activities and the difficulty of trying to find not only time to hunt, but a time to go through the hunter education course and to pass it, to fit it in amongst all their activities. And I would like to tell you that this bill would have a great opportunity for parents and, by the way, grandparents since March 2nd. I'm now the proud grandfather of a 6-pound, 3-ounce boy. That the bonding that opportunity that occurs between myself and my kids and now my grandchild in the future when he's old enough to go hunting is incalculable. And right now the ability for them to hunt big game is limited until age 12, and even more so is that the hunter education program and course is very difficult for anyone under 10 to really comprehend enough to pass. And so with this bill, I urge you to pass it. I hate to see the minimum age of 9 in there, because as a parent, some of my kids might be physically and mentally able to hunt at a younger age than 9, and some of them may not. But I feel that's my prerogative and my determination to determine their level of ability. So with that, if you have any questions.
Any questions?
Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And currently our last speaker, Al Elkins. And is Mr. Williams here as well?
Mr. Chair, Chair Roland, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. I have a real person with me today. This is Mr. Rick Williams, who is the Vice President of the Oregon Hunters Association. As you know, in all the testimony, I talk about the amount of money that we put in back in from our own coffers into the state. It averages over $250,000 a year in wildlife and habitat projects. It's due to the people like Mr. Williams, who not only works at the board level, administers our grant program, but also works with his chapter, and he has been the spark plug for a lot of the youth activities that we sponsor, and has put together a great youth program within his own chapter. So I've asked him to come and say a few words today about youth and hunting.
Thank you. Again, my name is Rick Williams, 314 Southeast 202nd in Portland, Oregon. I'm an Oregon native, and I have been fishing and hunting and enjoying the outdoors in Oregon for well more than 40 years. And as Al stated, I am Vice President of the Oregon Hunters Association and have been designated our outreach liaison. Most of that's due to the fact that I have had quite a bit of experience putting on youth events in our organization, 8 years in my own chapter, and I've been helping out at the state level for 2 full years now as the Vice President. I'd like to note that I participated in that hunters recruitment work group that was mentioned earlier as both a hunter, a father, and a designee of Oregon Hunters Association. And the findings that we came to out of that group, there was about 40 people, I believe, that started out, and we met over several meetings. I think it was 4 or 5 meetings. The findings that we came up with actually mirrored quite a bit what was stated in the Families of Field report that you've heard a little bit about earlier today. That report was not just sponsored by the Turkey Federation, but also the U.S. Sportsman's Alliance and the National Shooting Sports Foundation. Some of the decline factors that contributed to the declining number of hunters is the aging population of our hunters, the reduced access available to them, and reduced opportunities as a result of that, as well as the busy lifestyles. Those particular factors combined with the restrictive regulations make it real difficult for kids to participate at an age younger than 12 in Oregon. So it is a fact that kids that are not introduced early in life develop other interests. There's so many demands on our time these days that it is very difficult to get a kid that's over 12 years old interested in participating in anything. If you don't start it early, whatever that activity is going to be, it's not molded into their personality. They're not as likely to become a lifelong hunter or baseball player or whatever it is that you're looking to start them into. This mentor style program has been so far been implemented in 12 states. There's several more considering it right now, and it is safe. And one of the arguments that I heard by participating in this work group was that why would we want to put kids in the field at a younger age with guns? Well, to address that specific issue, the International Hunters Education Association, the IHEA, which is the national organization which speaks to these type of issues, sent out an open letter dated July 2005. I just have a couple of short excerpts to read from it. An analysis of youth hunting incidents shows that the major factor affecting youth hunting safety is the presence of an attentive, responsive adult hunter to supervise the youth. Most incidents happen in the absence of an adult supervisor or during a lapse in the adult supervision. That was their findings after a 5-year study of youth hunting incidents, or incidents that happened that involved youths. So his comment at the end of the letter is, the data is clear. Accompanied young hunters are safe. The facts do not support having laws restricting or limiting the age of hunters for safety reasons. So that kind of puts the argument to rest that taking kids out in the field at that age is unsafe. They actually are the safest segment of the hunters available today, or out in the field today. Surprisingly, the most unsafe segment is the people my age in the 40 to 50 age bracket, 40 to 50 year old age bracket. Youth hunters in general are a lot safer, and mentor youth hunters are about 15 times safer than just youth hunters. I would also like to restate that fact that Rod mentioned earlier, that of the 34,000 new hunters, that there was no accidents in those five states which were cited. Okay, one more thing I'd like to read to you just real quick. We were talking about the need for hunting and to continue the tradition of hunting, and why do we want to get kids involved. It's just a few short facts. Hunting is one of the safest recreational activities employed by families in the United States, bringing nearly 20 million men, women, and youth together to spend more quality time in the outdoors. Mentored youth hunters are the safest to field. Studies show that nearly 80% of Americans sport hunting. Hunters pump more than $30 billion into the American economy annually. About a million jobs in America are supported by hunters. America's recreational hunters and shooters have paid more than $5 billion in excise taxes since 1937 to support wildlife conservation and education. In the last 40 years, hunters have spent $13.4 billion purchasing hunting licenses, tags, and permits, which doesn't account for a significant percentage of the state wildlife fundings or agency funding. That's nationwide, of course, but Oregon is no different. And we have clearly identified that there's a need for a program like this. There's no logical factual reason to prevent kids from going in the field in this type of situation. And speaking on behalf of OHA, Oregon Hunters Association, myself as a lifelong Oregonian and as a father, I would urge you strongly to support this legislation.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. You mentioned that the 40 to 50 year olds were more on safety is kind of where I'm going. Why would they be why would the 9-year old be safer than a 40 year old?
For one, in a mentor situation, they're at arm's reach. Part of the criteria is that they're at arm's reach with the adult hunter. So they're able to be guided directly and impacted directly by having the mentor present. For kids that are hunting past this program, when like they currently do after they passed hunter safety and they're out in the field, they've just gone through our state's hunter safety program in order to be out there, and it is a good program, and OHA and myself personally, we do support it. However, there just appears to be a need to allow kids to get started a little earlier in order to get them to undertake this as a lifelong activity. I can't exactly speak to why the older contingent is becoming less safe. That's probably something that there's statistics available on, but I didn't come prepared to talk with the whys about that.
Madam Chair, excuse me, Chair okay. Roland, Representative Smith, I do know that's a statistic I've heard. I don't know exactly why that is, but I know that Mr. Anglin probably has an answer if he's awake back there.
Well, they can provide it. Thank you very much.
Certainly.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there any other people who would like to testify to House Bill 3165? Come forward.
Again, my name is Laurel Hines, and I wasn't planning to testify on this, but since I was listening, I thought I'd put my 2 cents worth in, and I realize it's probably not the safest thing to do with all these adult predators here, and I'm the only non-predator, it sounds like. Anyway, I guess I question that hunting is one of the safest sports, because I read all the time about hunters shooting each other and having heart attacks and all kinds of things. And I'll tell you, I've heard far fewer severe injuries hiking than I do about hunters shooting each other. I really think it sounds to me, the more I hear, that we need new ways of funding wildlife management. And instead of encouraging, having to sort of slightly brainwash people when they're young to become hunters.
My background is I'm a recently retired psychotherapist, and I've dealt with a lot of kids. And I really think that there's some young kids that are going out with parents at an early age to please the parent who can be traumatized by having killed an animal if they're not totally prepared for that mentally and emotionally. And there's some kids who aren't prepared for that mentally and emotionally. And when I was a social worker, I saw a number of kids who had been traumatized by seeing even farm animals killed that they had become attached to. So I'm not so sure it's a good idea to encourage very young children to learn to kill things for fun. I think it would be better to wait until they're at least 12 years old to see if they're ready for that, to see if their personality is formed well enough for that. I think that hunters are far more danger from each other than they are from the predators that are out there, because no cougar in Oregon has ever killed a hunter, as far as I don't think a cougar in Oregon has ever killed anybody statistically. So hunting is a dangerous sport, and I don't really like the idea of young children being out there with big guns that can kill humans as well as big animals. And even though the mentorship would probably provide some safety there, not all adults make good mentors. Some make excellent mentors and probably would provide more safety than otherwise. But I know there's a lot of irresponsible adults out there, and some of them are hunters. Luckily, not too many, hopefully. But anyway, it just doesn't sound like a good idea to me. Thank you very much.
Any questions? No. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, before you close, she actually brought up a very good point. And I am sitting on a search and rescue task force, and one of the issues is what is the population that we're spending more resources on searching and rescuing. And I will bring you in the statistics, because I believe hikers are the number one when attributed to what activity they were performing or taking part in. I think hiking was number one, but I think it is relevant to this.
Any other questions?
No, there's not enough money to go around, so we've got to charge more to somebody.
Okay, seeing no more questions and no one else here, we're going to close our public hearing on 3165. Just so the committee knows, I anticipate moving these relatively soon, but not today. So, thank you. Oh, and now we will close our hearing, our committee meeting on Ag and Natural Resources. Thank you all for being here.